Well, greetings everyone and welcome to the Law Hour and Editorial Review. The Law Hour is sponsored by the Gordon Law School of Isabella, Missouri. The Law Hour is an educational service brought to you in the public interest. I'm your narrator, George Gordon. The Law Hour and Editorial Review is heard nationally and internationally 7 days a week here in the United States and in more than 120 countries worldwide over the Internet. For more information about the Law Hour and Editorial Review, please visit our webpage at georgegordon.org. Again, that's georgegordon.org. The Law Hour and Editorial Review brings you important information about law, science, education, politics, religion, health, history, economics, news, and current events. So stay tuned for tonight's special report on Tell Them a Story when we come back. Hey, let me ask you this. What do you think's wrong with the Ten Commandments? Because it's pretty obvious by now that something's wrong with them because they have now been banned from our public schools, our public institutions, and our national consciousness. Now, instead of these 10 simple, time-tested laws, we see the 10 planks to the Communist Manifesto in their place, and they're teaching these 10 planks to the Communist Manifesto in our public schools, our public institutions. We've made them a part of our national psyche. You know, that's a pretty radical change in our political and moral outlook over the past 50 years, don't you think? Are you aware, for instance, that your daughter couldn't receive an aspirin in your public school without your consent, but your daughter can have an abortion arranged through that same public school nurse without even your knowledge, much less your consent? That's why I contend that the solution to this kind of moral perversion and national insanity is to go back to what worked. Let's go back to the Ten Commandments and the Mosaic Law. You know, our founding fathers practiced and advocated the Ten Commandments, and they even put 22 principles of that law into our federal constitution. And there's at least one school left in America that still teaches this entire Mosaic Law, the Ten Commandments, all 759 statutes, judgments, and commandments, as well as the penalties and the 33 benefits that we receive for their observance. Now, you know, every law has a penalty. You don't have to know what the penalty is to suffer from its effect. Now, whether we call this the Mosaic Law, the Law of God, the Common Law, Natural Law, or Karma, or something else, it's automatic. It works just like AIDS, herpes, and VD, which just happened to be the natural penalty for adultery. Now, if you'd like more information, why don't you call and order our free General Law CD package? That's the place to start. It's a 4-hour commentary on the law in general, and it's educational. It's informative. It's entertaining. It's free. You can call and order one right now. The number is 417-273-4967. Once more, that's area code 417-273-4967. If you're online, go to our website, georgegordon.org. georgegordon.org. Click on to the archives page. And you can download that free General Law CD package right there off of our website. That's georgegordon.org. All right, last time I said we'd take up this book written by Frohnjen, if that's the way to pronounce his name. I'll spell it for you one more time. I don't think you can get a copy of this. This looks like a private treatise to me. Walter M. Frohnjen. He wrote this in 1976. It's pretty old. Frohnjen. You can get a copy of it from the law school here. If you want one, call and ask about it, and we'll see if we can make a copy for you and send it to you. But meanwhile, back on the farm, it's a part and parcel of our courtroom strategy and procedures school. I'm not going to cover all of it. I don't have time to cover all of anything that I do here on the air. Here in the school, we cover it all. And we talk about it in detail, but let me give you a little flavor of what we're dealing with here. The courts I mentioned to you last time, you know, for the most part are pretty upright and they're pretty upstanding. They're not trying to screw you, blue you, and tattoo you like the politicians and the bankers and the news media are. There is some graft and corruption that goes on there, no doubt, but it's rare. And at the lower level, I don't think you're going to find that in the traffic courts and et cetera. These judges are making the right decisions based upon the pleadings that are in front of them. Our problems, boys and girls, is that we're making the wrong pleadings. And so in the last program, I tried to show you that. If you walk in there and you ask the wrong question, the judge will give you the correct answer to your wrong question. And when these polygamy cases, I just picked polygamy, you know, as an example, but when Reynolds walked in and he failed to plead his cause correctly, the Supreme Court came back and they ruled correctly based upon his incorrect pleading. Now today, and we're not having any problem with polygamy, there are some polygamists out there and they get crosswise with the law and they go to jail. All of the polygamists that practice polygamy according to the scripture aren't having any problems whatsoever. Polygamy is not against the law in the United States. Polygamy with marriage licenses is against the law in the United States. I've pointed out to you a time or two, there's no such thing as a draft in this country. What you're being subjected to here is cunning coercion, which deprives you of your rights. But, you know, if you can be cunningly coerced into waiving your rights due to your ignorance, that's your fault. You're the probable cause of your own injury. Now, to demonstrate that, let me tell you about some of the decisions that come out of our judges. The advice that the judges give. I have many, many times sat in a judge's chamber, and he will explain the law to me and tell me the answer to the riddle. And then when I go out and make my pleadings correctly, and then when I clean up my act and come in and make my case, the judge rules in my favor. That's why I've said I'm not complaining about the courts or the judges. Listen to this case here. It comes from Simmons versus U.S. 390 U.S. 389. And this court said, we find it intolerable that one constitutional right should have to be surrendered in order to assert another. All right, now if we just listen to that story right there, nobody can compel you to surrender one right in order to assert another one. Oftentimes the police will do that. They'll stack charges on you. Stacking charges on somebody is against the law. You can't do that. Do the police stack charges on people? Sure, every day. Do they get away with it? Only in those cases where the defendants let them get away with it. You know, if you're ignorant and you don't know what to do next, I guess people can do just about anything to you. Now, there's limits to police power, you know. The police don't have carte blanche. Now, they may think they do, but they don't. And they may exercise carte blanche, well, until they find somebody that knows the law and says, wait a minute, this far and no further. The courts are there to protect the rights of individuals who can come in and claim them. Now, here's a second case. It's called Miller versus U.S. The court said the claim and exercise of a constitutional right cannot be converted into a crime. Oftentimes, I've seen people, and I've done it myself, I've said, you know, I'm claiming all of my rights. For instance, I might say to the policeman, I'm claiming all of my rights at all times, and I waive none of my rights at any time for any cause or reason. And then the cop says, oh, you're one of those constitutionalists. Well, you're under arrest, and I'm charging you with assaulting an officer. Okay. Hell, he can arrest me and charge me with murder or anything he wants. Doesn't mean he can prove it. You know, just because you're arresting somebody and charging them. Now, it scares the hell out of people, you know, when they get charged. I heard of a case the other day, a lady called up, and she said she was having some problems here with the licensing board down in Texas, you know, medical licensing, I think it was. And they charged her with a felony, and they said, now, if you'll sign your car over to us, she's got a pretty fancy car, and then we'll drop the charge to a misdemeanor. Well, hell, isn't that blackmail? I mean, these are public officials, you know, that hold office. They're licensing examiners. But licensing people, you know, in these boards, they don't have the power to blackmail people and tell them, hey, I'm going to charge you with a felony over here to scare the hell out of you and cost you a lot of money defending against it. You know, this thing of stacking charges and charging people falsely, you know, is litigatable under the Civil Rights Act, you know. So, again, you know, if you pay the blackmail and shut up, well, yeah, they can do that and get away with it, but isn't it up to you to say, you know, this far and no further, right's right and wrong's wrong, and we're not going to do that? Isn't it your responsibility to expose this kind of evil? I was talking to Judge Clark here years ago. Now, he's dead now, but Judge Clark said to me, he said, we know what's going on down in Ozark County, but we can't do anything about it until somebody brings an action before us that's actionable so that we can do something. You can rest assured that judges know what's going on in your community. And if the citizens of the community are satisfied to take the kind of abuse that's coming from the police, well, they deserve it. And if the people in the community want to take action, bring it before the courts and say, listen, we've had enough of this, then the judges are there to bring an end to it. Let me tell you a little story about this. Down in Texas, they had some problems with overcrowding, you know, 20, 30 years ago. And to show you what kind of power federal judges have and how they're prepared, you know, to solve problems, this overcrowding is going on. And so some prisoner brought an overcrowding issue to a federal judge. And so he took a look at it and he said, yeah, you're right. This is overcrowding. This is against the law. You can't do that. And so he gave the prison officials down there some time. He said, now correct this. And they didn't correct it. And so the federal judge said, well, okay, that's no big deal. I'll just take over the prisons of Texas. And he did. Federal judge, he just took them over. And he ran them out of his chambers, part-time, you know. And some time went by, and so he went to the legislature, and he said, now we got to solve this overcrowding problem down here. And he said, now we need some money, and we want you to appropriate some money here so we can build some jails and correct this overcrowding. And the legislature said, hell no, we're not going to do that. And so the federal judge said, well, that's all right. So he started turning people loose. He didn't start turning the murderers loose, but, you know, you got people locked up in the jails down here, you know, for not paying their child support and so on, so he cut them loose. And, you know, some more time went by, and as time progressed along, and pretty soon the legislature down there woke up and smelled the coffee and said, well, I guess what we better do is start appropriating the money and so that we can get our jails and prisons back, because the feds are going to run them. It's just like the Civil War, you know. When the Civil War was open, the United States Army went down there and ran Virginia and North and South Carolina. And then when the people down there woke up to reality and said, well, I guess maybe we better start obeying the laws and taking control of things, and they took it back. And over time, the state of Texas now has control of their prison system again. Judge Clark up here, there was a case came down out of Kansas City, and he just took over the Kansas City school system. And he said, well, we need to fix this and that and another thing. And the people up there voted. And they said, well, we're not going to vote a tax increase up here and raise taxes and fix these problems with the schools. And so the judge just took over and set the taxes in Kansas City. Oh, there was a god-awful furor. They said, you can't do that. That's not democratic. You can't come up here and set the tax rates for our schools. And the Supreme Court said, sure you can. And then the people of Kansas City woke up to the fact that, yeah, you know, if that's what it's going to take. There have been times, you know, in history when judges have come up with conclusions and said, okay, here's what we've got to do in Little Rock. And the people said, no, we're not going to do that. And then the next thing they have is the, you know, the army down there running their schools. So the judicial system works if you know how to make it work. And there have been a number of cases where, you know, people have said, hey, enough's enough, and so we want to see if we can't get this to work. Now, listen to this one. There can be no sanction or penalty imposed upon one because of his exercise of a constitutional right. Well, I told you about Judge Schmidt. Asked me one time, how many rights do you have? And I babbled off about 10 or 5 or something like that. And he said, well, you got 1,100. But here's the trick to rights. You don't have any rights that you can't claim. You can't claim a right that you don't know about. So if you're going to claim a right, and I hear people, I've got rights. I've got rights. Oh, okay. Well, then why don't you go into court and claim them? They don't know what to claim, and then when they get there, they babble. And then the judge, you know, he's got rules to go by. There are rules that this game is played by. And our problem is the citizens of America, and I would just bet you the citizens of Australia and the citizens of Canada do not know what their rights are and do not know what the rules of court are. The prosecutor does. So he comes in there, he knows the rules and comes in and plays the game. You don't know the rules and then you complain because you can't win. Well, it's just a matter of learning the rules. And that's not any big trick. My analysis of the legal system here in the United States is that anyone who's a competent ninth grader could master it. I'm not sure that you could master it in the third or fourth or fifth grade. I'm not going to exaggerate like that. But, you know, by the time you're in the ninth grade, I think I was a freshman in high school, and I could master any of these legal principles that are extant, any of the rules of procedure, any of the rules of evidence, rules of court. Ninth grade, I could have handled that. 14 years old. I've said before, anybody whose IQ will match the speed limit can probably do this. Law is not that difficult. Now listen to these three. Three statements by three different judges, U.S. versus Dickerson, Belknap versus U.S., and Marchetti versus U.S. Who would believe the ironic truth that the cooperative taxpayer fares much worse than the individual who relies upon his constitutional rights? U.S. versus Dickerson. Listen to this judge. He says, you can and must keep your mouth shut for protection under the Fifth Amendment. In Belknap versus U.S. And in Marchetti, the judge said the constitutional privilege was intended to shield the guilty and the imprudent, as well as the innocent and the farsighted. Again, it's a matter of pleadings. All of the evidence that's ever going to be used against you is going to be furnished by you. Every time I watch one of these cop shows, you know, on television, I kind of sit there and smile and chuckle as the police are questioning this guy and he just spills his guts, you know. And that's the kind of crap that you people feed your minds on. And then you wonder why it is your rights don't work. Did you hear what this judge said? You can and must keep your mouth shut for protection under the Fifth Amendment. Now, when you went to public school, see, they taught you to open your mouth and spill all. There was always show and tell time. Well, that's fine when you're in kindergarten, but you know when you get out here in the real world, the policeman is your adversary. If you think he's your friend, you got your head up the wrong end of your anatomy here again. His job, his training, his job is to gather the evidence that he needs to convict you. So when he asks you questions like, hey, have you been drinking? Well, yeah, but I've only had two beers. Well, now you're admitting that you're drinking. Out of your own mouth. Well, how many? Well, I've only had a couple of beers. Well, we've established that you're drinking. You're intoxicated. Now we just need to find out how intoxicated are you. All you need to do is give him your license. You don't need to say another word from that point on. Not a word. And I venture a guess that there isn't anybody out there listening to me that could confront a policeman in a traffic stop on the highway and keep his mouth shut. You don't know how. And if you can't and you won't, well then, whatever you tell him can and will be used against you in a court of law. Some guy says to me, well, what about my Miranda warning? What the hell do you need a Miranda warning for? You're volunteering the information. Sometimes people are cunningly coerced, you know. If you don't answer my questions, I'm going to arrest you. Hell, he's going to arrest you anyway. And then he says, well, if you don't answer my questions, I'm going to arrest you. So you answer all the questions, give him all the evidence that he needs, and he says, well, you're under arrest. You're drunk. Every time I hear that, I can't help but shake my head and say, well, okay. Now, here's a statement made by Hale versus Hinkle. We're of the opinion that there's a clear distinction in this particular between an individual and a corporation, and that the latter, the corporation, has no right to refuse to submit its books and papers for an examination at the suit of the state. But the individual may stand upon his constitutional rights as a citizen. The individual is entitled to carry on his private business in his own way. The individual's power to contract is unlimited. The individual owes no duty to the state or to his neighbors to divulge his business or to open his doors to an investigation so far as it may tend to incriminate him. The individual owes no such duty to the state since he receives nothing therefrom. Receives nothing from the state therefrom. Receives nothing from the state therefrom. You know, Americans receive a lot of benefits from the state, licensing and so on, and you volunteer into these regulated enterprises, and then you wonder why you've got a chancellor that doesn't recognize your rights. It's because you don't have any rights. You've already contracted them away. The Supreme Court declared that the privilege afforded not only extends to answers that would in themselves support a conviction under a federal criminal statute, but likewise embraces those which would furnish a link in the chain of evidence needed to prosecute the claimant for a federal crime. The claimant is not required to prove the precise danger, since by so doing, he would be forced to disclose those very facts which the privilege protects. I've often found that the thing that just drives everybody nuts is when you don't open your mouth and say anything. I mean, total silence. I've been asked, are you deaf? Are you a mute? Are you a deaf mute? And then I don't shake my head, and I don't answer. Just drives everybody nuts. Nobody believes that you can remain silent. I can. I've tested it a few times. It's kind of fun, kind of funny. The respondent is in fear of federal prosecution for violation of federal tax laws. And there is no federal statute which would grant immunity to the respondent for the specific offenses set forth in 26 U.S.C. Section 7102 through 7210. So in the absence of a federal statute granting immunity for the specific offense to which the question relates, states cannot compel disclosure. Search and seizure, Fourth Amendment, Fifth Amendment rights are very important, and search and seizure law report lays out the parameters. The Supreme Court rules on the Fourth Amendment more often than any other section of the Constitution. There are certain landmark cases that come down that when we read those cases and then we... Those are stories. A case is a story. And when we read those stories, then it gives us the level of understanding that we need so that we can apply our wisdom to figuring out what the outcome is going to be based upon the statements that we make. And as a result of that, these judges in these opinions in these cases are actually giving us the guidance that we need to keep the government from convicting us. That's the value that I just mentioned to you here in these cases that are contained in this book, which is called Quotations. These are called legal quotations. For asserting the privilege against self-incrimination, the respondent is to suffer no penalty. For asserting the privilege against self-incrimination. Now, the Army has a little saying. You know, when you're captured, you're to give them your name, rank, and serial number, and that's it. They instruct the soldiers, you know, here's what you have to give them, your name, your rank, and your serial number. That's it. Have you ever thought about telling the policeman my name, rank, and serial number, and then shut up? You're a prisoner. Now, sometimes the cop will say, oh, you're not in custody. Well, does that mean that you have to spill your guts? Answer his question. Why don't you ask the policeman a question every time he asks you a question and see if he'll answer your questions? He won't. But you will. And then as a result of that, you complain that your rights have been violated or something. The privilege against self-incrimination is neither accorded to the passive resistant nor to the person who is ignorant of his rights, not to one who is indifferent thereto. The self-incrimination clause is a fighting clause, and its benefits can be retained only by sustained combat. It cannot be claimed by your attorney or solicitor, and it's valid only when insisted upon by a belligerent claimant in person. Your rights to remain silent can only be insisted upon by a belligerent claimant in person. Now, I'm not talking about the belligerent claimant who assaults the police officer. You can't assault people. You know, I watch some of these cop shows sometimes, and some of these guys are pretty damn nutty, you know. And they're pretty funny sometimes, you know, watching the cop shows, you know, and you watch how these people behave, and you just kind of shake your head and say, you know, where'd these people come from? Ork or someplace, you know, somewhere out in outer space. But the judges now, listen, you know, their comments here are pretty damn straightforward, I'd say. They're not exaggerating. They're just telling you this is the way this comes down. You can't be compelled to do that, but if you do it voluntarily, you know, if you can't keep your mouth shut and you go out here and you blab all, well then, let's take a look at some counsel cases here. The right to counsel is very precious, and it must not be arbitrarily denied without a hearing. So you're entitled to counsel. Now, most people would say, well, you know, I'm entitled to a lawyer, and people will hire a lawyer, and one thing and another. Well, it's true that all lawyers are counselors, but it is not true that all counselors are lawyers. And the Sixth Amendment guarantees you the right to counsel and counsel of your choice. Federal judges don't have any problem with that. State judges typically do. A state or federal court which arbitrarily refuses to hear a party by counsel employed by and representing him in any case, civil or criminal, denies the party a hearing and therefore denies him due process of law in the constitutional sense. Reynolds versus Cochran. Contemporary Supreme Court decisions which reinforce the defendant's absolute right to freely exercise his right to counsel stated in the Constitution. NAACP v. Button. Brotherhood of Railroad Trainmen's a good one versus Virginia State Bar dealing with pro se litigation. Pro se litigants. Lack of counsel of choice can be conceivably even worse than no counsel at all, or of having to accept counsel beholden to one's adversary. What happens here when the judge appoints the public defender? But what if you didn't want the public defender and the judge forced him on you? I have had that happen a couple of times. There's a solution to the problem. The other day I told you about a young fellow. They were trying to get him into the state mental hospital. So he headed him off at the pass. He went down and he got his... See, you don't have to be in there for 90 days to be shown competent. You can go in. It takes 3 hours. So this thing of locking you up for 90 days to see if you're competent or not, you could do yourself for $150 in 3 hours at your own psychiatrist. He's state licensed, you know. You can head this off at the pass. I showed you that the other day. So lack of counsel of choice can be conceivably even worse than no counsel at all, or of having to accept counsel beholden to one's adversary. Well, listen, the government is your adversary, and they want you to accept their lawyer. Does that sound very logical to you? I mean, the judge is working for the state. The state has brought an action against you. The state's prosecutor is prosecuting you. The state's policeman is testifying against you. The judge is being paid by the state. And then the judge says, oh, by the way, we have a state-licensed lawyer who's being paid by the state who is your antagonist. Huh? What would you think if we brought you into the Gordon Court of Justice here? And I said, well, my wife's going to act as the judge, my son's going to act as the prosecutor, I'll act as the witness against you, and we're going to charge you with a crime here and prosecute you in the Gordon Court of Justice. You'd say, well, that's a kangaroo court. What in the hell do you think you got in Missouri or Texas or California? These are admiralty courts. These are chancery courts. They're actually military courts, is what they boil down to. And then you're not being afforded the due process and equal protection guaranteed under your Constitution, but then you're not common law free men and you're not entitled to it. You're sailors on a ship with seamen's papers, and they're taking you into the chancellor or the captain here for summary process. But would you like to learn how to use your rights and how to get your constitutional rights and use them? And that's what legal education is all about. Hey, I got to give you a reminder here that you're listening to The Law Hour, an editorial review. We're sponsored by the Gordon Law School of Isabella, Missouri. The Law Hour is heard 7 days a week here in the United States. We're heard around the world in more than 120 countries daily over the internet and radio. If you'd like more information about the Law School and the Law Hour, then please go to our website at georgegordon.org, georgegordon.org. Now, the law school teaches family law, tax law, courtroom strategy and procedure, business law, agricultural law, civil rights, and biblical law from the scriptural perspective. That's 8 schools in all. The law school is a private, non-commercial, non-profit, non-sectarian law school. It is open to individuals, but by prearrangement. Now, the law school conducts a homeschooling program for adults on compact disc, and the Law Hour website is updated weekly. It has a radio log schedule and archives. All of it can be accessed through our website at georgegordon.org. All of these Law Hour programs are archived on the internet by title and date for your listening convenience, and the Law Hour is an educational service brought to you in the public interest. Now, the law school offers a free 4-hour introductory CD package. Now, you can order one by simply calling the law school and asking for it. And the number to call is 417-273-4967. Again, that's area code 417-273-4967. Now, the sources of information that we use on this program are true, accurate, and correct to the best of our knowledge and belief, and the Law Hour and editorial review gives credit to those authors and publications that we use on this program. We often endorse or recommend books, papers, periodicals, and newsletters to our listeners. Now, these endorsements or recommendations that we give don't mean that the authors or publications that we're endorsing are necessarily going to reciprocate. Keep in mind that most of these authors and publications that we cite here on the Law Hour may be political, religious, economic, sectarian, racial, or ethnic partisans, and their viewpoints may not be totally endorsed by the Law Hour and Editorial Review either. These opinions, beliefs, comments, views, and expressions that you hear on this program are mine. They're mine alone. They don't necessarily represent the views, beliefs, or the opinions of the advertisers, the sponsors, the management, or the staff of this radio network or of this local radio station. So if you'd like more information about the Law Hour and Editorial Review, please go to our website at georgegordon.org, georgegordon.org, or call us direct at 417-273-4967. All right, we're talking about legal quotations here. I'm going to tell you a story as it relates to this thing of your pleadings. And sometimes prosecutors and lawyers and others have agendas that they want to advance. Sometimes it's propaganda. There was a neat case came out of a place called Morton Grove, Illinois, back in the 80s. It's pretty old now, but it had to do with gun control. And back in the 80s, when gun control was pretty popular and people were trying to get more and more of it, this little town of Morton Grove, Illinois, enacted gun control legislation. They prohibited the citizens of the town from owning a gun. They said, hey, you can't own a gun here. Now, there was a lawyer in the town, and the lawyer in the town decided that that was unreasonable. It infringed upon his right to keep and bear arms, violated his Second Amendment right. And, by God, I'm not going to sit still for this. Now, that would indicate to all of us that, you know, he's a pro-gun fellow, and he's out here trying to help, you know, with the fight against these gun grabbers. Well, he filed an action in the state district court, and he said, hey, this is a wrong law, it's a wrong-headed law, and it violates my rights, and he cited the Second Amendment to the federal Constitution. He cited the amendments and the statutes that, you know, guarantee and protect his right in Illinois and so on. So some time went by, and pretty soon the district court judge dismissed his action. I don't know if it was with or without prejudice, but he dismissed it. Now, I would imagine he dismissed it with prejudice because he had to take it up to the Illinois Court of Appeals on appeal, which he did. And God love him, you know, he didn't give up and quit the fight just because some gun-grabbing judge down here at the lower court level wouldn't hear his argument. So, I mean, he wants his day in court. He wants to be able to produce witnesses, evidence, and testimony and come in here and get this Morton Grove law repealed, taken off the books, because it violates his constitutional rights. He says this law is wrong and it needs to be reviewed, and I'm going to bring it to the court's attention. So the Illinois Court of Appeals, you know, entertains his appeal. They listen to it. And, well, they didn't listen to it. He didn't get into oral argument now, but they read it, and they took a look at it, and they dismissed it. Can you believe this? It would make the rest of us in the country think that Illinois and the judicial system over there is just made up of gun-grabbing judges that are hell-bent on denying citizens their right to their day in court. The lower court dismissed, now the Court of Appeals dismisses, but our champion, our hero, our lawyer, he's not dissuaded. He says, you know, a fight's a fight. So he appeals to the Illinois State Supreme Court. So the Illinois State Supreme Court, they don't grant him a hearing either. They look at it, and they spend a little time on it, and they send it back, and they dismissed it also. I don't know if it was with or without prejudice, but my guess is that they probably dismissed without prejudice. He didn't bring it up for a rehearing that I knew of. Well, now all he's got left is the United States Supreme Court. And a fellow came in my office. This is back at Barrister's Inn days. This is back in 82, 3, 4, 5, somewhere along in there up in Boise. came in my office and says, "You've been watching the newspaper here on this Morton Grove gun control case?" And then I said, "Well, I don't know any more about it than what I see in the paper." And he said, "Well, you know, they've dismissed that out in Illinois 3 times on this guy, and he's taken it up to the U.S. Supreme Court." And he said, "How do you think the U.S. Supreme Court's going to rule on it?" And I said, "Well, they're not going to rule on it. They're going to dismiss it just like the District Court and the Appeals Court and the Supreme Court of Illinois." And he looked at me kind of surprised, and he said, "Well, why?" And I said, "Because he doesn't have any standing." And the guy said, "He doesn't have what?" I said, "He doesn't have any standing." And this guy said, "What's that?" And I said, "Well, he doesn't have a real and vital controversy at issue. He's never been damaged by the operation of the statute. And there's a vital case, it's a landmark case, that deals with this thing of standing. And it deals with, I'll see if I can find the case here for you. Ashwander versus Tennessee Valley Authority is what the name of the case is. Constitutional Law and Supreme Courts. Here it is right here. Ashwander versus Tennessee Valley Authority, cited at 297 U.S. 288. That's for all of you students out there that want to look this up. 297 U.S. 288, 1936, Justice Brandeis concurring. I don't know who wrote it, but Brandeis concurred. Now, here's what the court had to say about this guy, this Morton Grove guy. And the court has frequently called attention to the great gravity and delicacy of its function in passing upon the validity of an act of Congress, and has restricted exercise of this function by rigid insistence that the jurisdiction of federal courts is limited to actual cases and controversies, and that they have no power to give advisory opinions. And on this ground, it has in recent years ordered the dismissal of several suits challenging the constitutionality of important acts of Congress. Well, boys and girls, don't you think the Second Amendment's a pretty important act? I did. I thought it was. Now, the state courts in Illinois dismissed him out 3 times. That is, the District Court, the Appeals Court, and the Supreme Court. Now he's in the U.S. Supreme Court. My student says to me, "Well, what do you think? How do you think the Supreme Court's going to rule?" I said, "They're going to dismiss it." And then I said, "Watch this. The newspapers are going to write a headline. And the headline is going to say, 'U.S. Supreme Court upholds Morton Grove gun control ordinance.'" Do you hear that? The Supreme Court is going to dismiss it. They're not going to hear it. And the news media, all of them, they're going to say, when they report this, "U.S. Supreme Court upholds Morton Grove gun control ordinance." And sure enough, that's what they said in the Idaho Statesman. And I'll bet you that if you were reading the Los Angeles Times or the New York Times or the Sandusky Gazette, that's exactly what they reported. And that was a propaganda ploy by the attorney. That attorney knew that he didn't have standing. He was looking for propaganda. He came out and pretending that he was a friend of guns. He was a friend of the Second Amendment. No, he wasn't. He was a gun grabber looking for publicity, trying to persuade the people that read the newspapers that the courts supported the position that gun ownership or that gun control was collective, not individual. Now, I was disappointed in the decision out of the Supreme Court on the Second Amendment. It came out 5-4, but it should have been 9-0. You got 4 gun grabbers on the court. I'm pretty sure of that. But now, it could well be that they've got some legal thing in the back of their minds over there that I'm not familiar about. I, I don't know everything that there is to know on law. Oliver Wendell Holmes was asked that one time by a clerk. He said, how much law do you know? And the judge said, I don't know very much law. And his clerk was surprised that the judge would say he didn't know very much law. And the judge came back and he said, well, it's a fact. I don't know very much law. But he said, I am God awful good at the little bit that I do know. I don't know much, but I'm good at what I do know. Well, the court has developed for its own governance in the cases confessedly within its jurisdiction a series of rules under which it has avoided passing upon a large part of all of the constitutional questions passed upon it or pressed upon it for decision. And they've got seven rules here. So if you want to qualify a case for appellate review, not just the Supreme Court of the United States, but if you want to get a case heard by your Court of Appeals, or hell, if you just want a trial de novo, for crying out loud, there are rules of court, and we have to follow those rules. Pro se litigants are not good at following the rules. Prosecutors are perfect. They never miss. Prosecuting attorneys, by golly, those guys, they practice the game by the rules. If they ever shunt a rule aside or something like that, it's because they know that they can do it and get away with it because their opponent over here can't call them on it. And the judge isn't likely to. All right, here's the first rule that you have to follow in order to get a case qualified for appellate review. It says the court will not pass upon the constitutionality of legislation in a friendly, non-adversary proceeding, declining because to decide such questions is legitimate only in the last resort and as a necessity in the determination of real, earnest, and vital controversies between individuals. Now, in this case, there is no real vital controversy at issue. Think about it. Now, the way you create a real controversy at issue is that you have to create a damage first. If there's no damage, there's no issue. So to create a damage, you strap on a 45, you walk down Main Street, walk up to the chief of police and say, Bob, I'm packing heat. What are you going to do about it? Not concealed now. You got to be carrying it out in the open. I own this gun. I'm packing it openly and notoriously. What are you going to do about it? Now, if the chief of police had his head on straight, he'd say, I ain't going to do anything about it. You may be black, but I'm going to let you ride the front of the bus. Can you imagine where we'd be today if that bus driver and that cop had let Rosa Parks ride the front of the bus? Hell, there wouldn't be any issue, would there? So, you've got to have what we call in law a goat. If you want to test some legal issue, somebody's got to step up there and be the goat. Rosa Parks was that goat. The NAACP got together with the ACLU, and they said, hey, let's go test this issue. Let's go find somebody and get them out here and have them break the law. And then when they break that law, if in fact this law is a violation of our Constitution, the courts will listen to it because this woman's been arrested and jailed and she's been damaged. In the Yoder case, he was damaged. He was fined $5. You know, it doesn't make any difference if they fine you $5, $500, $5,000, or $5 million. You know, $5 is a damage. A damage is what we have to have if we're going to walk into court and get anybody to take cognizance of the case. Got to have a real and vital controversy at issue. Number two, the court will not anticipate a question of constitutional law in advance of the necessity of deciding it. It's not the habit of the court to decide questions of a constitutional nature unless absolutely necessary to a decision in the case. So what that's telling us is that if there's two things that we can decide the case on, one, the policeman over here didn't read the guy his rights. And then there's a constitutional issue concerning the Fourth Amendment, let's say, in a search and seizure. Well, they'll come back and they'll rule on the statutory portion of it. or on some common ruling that's come down before, and they won't decide the constitutional issue. Is that right and wrong? I don't know. Hell, I don't make these rules, boys and girls. I'm just little Georgie Gordon, and I'm not here to argue with the courts. I don't make the rules of procedure, the rules of courts. I didn't design this Ashwander doctrine over here, but I'm here to tell you, this is the way the game is played. And if you don't play the legal game by these rules, you can't win. That's all. Now, there's not all that many rules to learn, but there are some rules to learn, and once we teach you how to do legal research and follow the rules, why then, like I said, you know, if your IQ is anywhere above the speed limit, hell, you're on your way. Number three, the court will not formulate a rule of constitutional law any broader than is required by the precise facts to which it's to be applied. Have you noticed how many times the court has ruled on abortion? And they haven't overturned Roe versus Wade yet, have they? Nobody's ever brought up a case that'll overturn Roe v. Wade. Not that it needs overturning. I'm not suggesting that it does. I'm just saying that a lot of people want to see that it gets overturned, one thing and another. Nobody's ever brought up any case that'll do that. And the court keeps ruling on it, but they just rule on the specific issue that is raised that needs to be answered, and they don't go any further. They don't try to answer questions that may come up in the future. If it comes up in the future, we'll answer it. If it doesn't, we're not going to answer it here today. Now, number four, the court will not pass upon a constitutional question, although properly presented by the record, if there is also present some other ground upon which the case may be disposed of. I had a student one time named Kitty, and she took a case up to the Supreme Court of Utah, and there was a technical move. You know, the prosecutor didn't dot his I or cross his T or something like that. And then there was a constitutional question. So the court came back and said, gee, Mrs. Burton, you win. Look at this. Congratulations. You win on this technical move. And then she wrote a letter back and said, yeah, but what about the constitutional issue? And they came back, oh, we're not going to answer that. Don't need to. Since you've already won your case and you're now dismissed out, we don't need to open up Pandora's box here and answer questions that aren't before the court. Number five, the court will not pass upon the validity of a statute upon complaint of one who fails to show that he's been injured by its operation. And our good lawyer here cannot show that he's been injured by the operation of the statute. He hasn't been arrested. He hasn't paid any fines. He hasn't spent any time in jail. He hasn't been sentenced. My wife one time, she was convicted for trespassing, and then the judge would not pass sentence. Well, that's a pretty crafty move on the part of the judge. He can't be appealed because you can't appeal the conviction. You can only appeal the sentence. You don't appeal the verdict. You appeal the sentence. And so I thought, old Charlie Brown, I thought, you know, Charlie, I thought you were really dumb. I had to give that judge credit. He's not one of the smartest judges I've ever run across. You know, I mean, he's not the sharpest marble in the drawer. But even a dumb judge can come up with a pretty crafty response from time to time. And then, boy, I thought that was a crafty response. So here my wife stands today, 20 years later, convicted of trespass. It's on her record. She's convicted. Never sentenced. Never spent any time in jail. Never paid any fine. Never appealed. You know. Just kind of sitting there in limbo. It'll be there for 1,000 years or two or five. Number six calls for the court will not pass upon the constitutionality of a statute at the instance of one who has availed himself of the benefits. So, like the dog that returns to his vomit mentioned in the Bible, if you avail yourself of the benefits and then come in and complain about the operation of the statute, like you want to complain about the income tax and you've been taking unemployment insurance? Oh, God. How many times do I see that come up? People are over here, they love the benefits, and then they complain about it. Huh, I think that Social Security and unemployment insurance and income tax and all that's bad, you know, and one thing and another. But they're right there to line up and, like the politicians at the pig trough, to take their share. Number 7, when the validity of an act of Congress is drawn into question. And even if a serious doubt of constitutionality is raised, it is a cardinal principle that this court will first ascertain whether a construction of the statute is fairly possible by which the question may be avoided. Well, Heibel versus Nevada is a case in point, but there's other principles that come into play here. That is, they're going to ascertain whether a construction of the statute, and I've been asked, well, what do you think about Barack Obama's health care plan? Is that unconstitutional? I don't think so. What's unconstitutional about it? I don't think that it even addresses or even comes up under the Constitution. I think that it was very craftily done, just like Social Security. It's contractual. It's not constitutional. People said, Well, aren't you afraid of that, Mr. Gordon? Hell, I'm exempted. I didn't read it, but somebody told me on page 18, a student called me the other day, said, page 18 has a religious exemption in there. Well, even if it wasn't written, even if they didn't have a written religious exemption in it, I would claim my religious exemption as a Hebrew under the First Amendment pursuant to Seeger under Hale. I don't have any great qualms about national health care insurance. I think it was a mistake. I think it's bad. You know, just like the income tax, I think it's a bad policy for all of us bottom feeders down here. I think Social Security is bad, but then I'm not complaining because I'm not paying the income tax or Social Security. So it doesn't affect me, and I'm not going to participate in the health care program either. And there's lots of people that aren't going to participate in the health care program. A lot of people don't participate in the income tax. A lot of people don't participate in Social Security. Social Security, the income tax, national health care insurance, the draft, they don't apply to people that are exempted. So why don't you think about the law from the point of view of the judges? And as I've said in the past, that the judicial power is where the real power in America lies. It's not in your political process. I mean, you can sit there and vote until hell freezes over. You ain't going to change anything. But in the courts, you can. And I'm not complaining about the IRS or the EPA or the State Tax Commission. I used to, but I don't anymore. I quit playing in the game, and so, you know, once I dropped out of the game, they don't bother me. They're not after me. Congress does not assume to deal with non-taxpayers. It's the taxpayers that they're concerned about. Well, I'm about out of time again here, boys and girls. We'll have to leave it right there and remind you that you have been listening to The Law Hour, an editorial review. We're sponsored by the Gordon Law School of Isabella, Missouri. Now, The Law Hour is heard 7 days a week here in the United States. We're heard around the world in more than 120 countries daily over the Internet and radio. If you'd like more information about the law school and the Law Hour, please go to our website at georgegordon.org. The law school teaches family law, tax law, courtroom strategy and procedure, business law, agricultural law, civil rights, and biblical law from the scriptural perspective. Now it's 8 schools and all. The law school is a private, non-commercial, non-profit, non-sectarian law school that is open to individuals, but by prearrangement. Now, the law school conducts a homeschooling program for adults on compact disc, and the Law Hour website is updated weekly, and it has our radio log schedule and archives. Now, the Law Hour is an educational service brought to you in the public interest. Hey, I'm out of time. I got to leave it right there. We'll see you back here tomorrow night, same time, same station, God willing, of course. So until then, thanks for listening, everybody, and good night, friends.